Chapter 4. Esayers 12, 21, 12, 16. They called the asteroid Esayers 8912, the only name it had ever had, drawn from an ancient catalog. Esayers 12 was a potato-shaped lump of slag half a kilometer long. The red consensus hovered over its bulging equator, anchored by a guy line. Lindsay pulled himself one-handed down the line. Glimpsed through his faceplate, the asteroid was dark, with long coal-powder streaks of carbonaceous ore. Cold gray and white blurs marked the chart impact points of primeval collisions. The biggest craters were 80 meters across, huge lava sumps of cracked slag and splattered glass. Lindsay landed. The expanse beneath his boots was like pumice, a static off-white surface of petrified bubbles. He could see up and down the asteroid's length, but its width curved out of sight behind a horizon a dozen steps away. He bent and pulled himself along, gripping knobs and cavities with the rough fingers of his gauntlets. The right hand was bad. The tough interior fabric of the glove felt soft as cotton to his nerve-burned fingers. He crawled, legs bobbing aimlessly, over the rim of an oblong crater, the scarred gouge of some glancing collision. It was five times as deep as he was tall, and its floor was a long, gas-smoothed blister of greenish basalt. A long, bloated ridge of molten rock had almost lifted free into space but then frozen, preserving every last ripple and warp. It slid aside. The rock ridge shriveled, crumpling like silk, its warps and bumps revealed as shaded camouflage on a plastic film. A cavern yawned below. It was a tunnel, curving just below the surface. Lindsay picked his way cautiously down the slope and flung himself into the tunnel. He braced himself against its walls. Stretching overhead, he pushed against the tunnel's ceiling to plant his feet. Sunlight dawned over the tiny horizon and fell into the tunnel. It was precisely circular and inhumanly smooth. Six tracks of thin metallic ribbon had been epoxied into place, running lengthwise along the corridor. In raw sunlight, the tracks had the gleam of copper. The tunnel apparently girdled the asteroid. It curved rapidly like the horizon. Before him, almost hidden by the tunnel's curvature, he glimpsed the dim sheen of brown plastic. Jumping and shoving along the walls, he bounced toward it in free fall. It was a plastic film with an inert fabric airlock. Lindsay pulled the zippered airlock tag and stepped in. He zipped it up behind him, undid a second zipper in the lock's inner wall, and climbed through. He was in a cavernous black and ochre balloon. It had been blown up within the tunnel, filling it tightly. A figure in a plastic decontamination suit floated upside down from the ceiling, a bright green silhouette against hand-sprayed black arabesques on an ochre background. Lindsay's suit had gone flat, indicating air pressure. He took his helmet off and inhaled cautiously. It was an oxy-nitrogen mix, standard air. Lindsay held his right arm across his chest with deliberate awkwardness.
I have a prepared statement to read, if you have no objection.
Please proceed.
The woman's voice was thin, half-muffled. He glimpsed her face behind the plate. Cold eyes, tawny skin, dark hair held in a green net. Lindsay read the words slowly, without inflection. "Greetings from the Fortuna Miners' Democracy. We are an independent nation, operating under the rule of law, firmly predicated on the basis of individual civil rights. As emigrants into our national territory, new members of the body politic are subject to a brief naturalization process before assuming full citizenship. We regret any inconvenience caused by the imposition of a new political order. It is our policy that ideological differences be settled by a process of negotiation. To that end, we have deputized our Secretary of State to establish preliminary terms, subject to ratification by the Senate. It is the wish of the Fortuna Miners' Democracy, as expressed in House Joint Resolution 16, 67th Session, that you begin negotiation without delay under the Secretary's aegis, so that the interim period may be as brief and as secure as possible. We extend our future citizens the hand of friendship and warm congratulations. Signed, President.
Lindsay looked up.
You'll want a copy of this, he said, extending it. The Shaper woman floated closer. Lindsay saw that she was beautiful. It meant very little. Beauty was cheap among Shapers. She took the document. Lindsay pulled more from his hip valise with his left hand.
These are my credentials. He handed them over, a wad of recycled printout, gaudy with Fortuna foil seals.
The woman said, My name is Nora Mavrides. The rest of the family has asked me to convey to you our impression of the situation. We feel that we can convince you that the actions you've taken are rash, and that you can profit by turning your attention elsewhere. We ask for nothing but the time to convince you. We have even shut down our main gun.
Lindsay nodded. That's nice. Very good. Should impress the government very much. I'd like to see this gun.
We are inside it, said Nora Mavrides.
Aboard the Red Consensus, 22-12-16. Lindsay said, I played dumb, but I don't think she bought it. He was addressing a joint session of the House and Senate, with the Speaker of the House presiding. The President was in the audience. The Supreme Court justices were manning the gun in control room, listening in on an intercom. The President shook his head. She believed it. Shapers always think we're stupid. Hell, to Shapers we are stupid.
Lindsay said, We're tethered just past the outlet of their launch ring. It's a long circular tunnel, a ring around the rock's center of gravity, cored just under the surface. It has magnetic strips for acceleration and some kind of magnetic launch bucket.
I heard of those, said Justice Three over the intercom. He was the regular gunner, a former miner, close to a century old. It starts with just a little boost, get that bucket up magnetized. Rides on a magnetic cushion, then you accelerate it, let it zip around a while, then brake it just behind the outlet. The bucket slows, but the cargo shoots out at clicks per second.
Clicks per second? Said the Speaker of the House. That could blow us away.
No, said the President. They'd have to use a lot of power for a launch. This close, we'd pick up the magnetics.
They won't let us in, Lindsay said. Their family lives clean, no microbes, or only tailored ones, and we have Zaibatsu stuff in every pore. They're going to offer us loot to go away.
That's not our assignment, the Speaker said. We can't judge their loot unless we see their quarters, Rep. 1 said.
The young Shaper renegade brushed at her hair with enameled fingertips. She had been dressing well lately.
We can dig our way in with the excavator, the President said. We'll use the sonar readings we made. We got a good idea of the closest tunnels to the surface. We could core in 5-10 minutes, while state negotiates. He hesitated. They might kill us for it.
The Speaker's voice held cold certainty.
We're dead anyway if they keep holding us off at arm's length. Our gun is short range. That launch ring can plaster us hours after we leave.
They didn't do it before, said Rep. 1.
Now they know who we are.
There's only one thing for it, the President said. Put it to a vote.
Essayers 12, 23-12-16.
We're a miners' democracy, after all, Lindsay told Nora Mavrides. According to Fortuna ideology, we had a perfect right to drill. If you'd mapped your tunnel network for us, this wouldn't have happened.
You risked everything, Nora Mavrides said.
You have to admit there were benefits, Lindsay said. Now that your network has been, as you say, contaminated, we can at least meet face to face without spacesuits.
It was reckless, Secretary.
Lindsay touched his chest left-handed.
Look at it from our perspective, Dr. Mavrides. The FMD will not wait indefinitely to take possession of its own property. I think we've been quite reasonable. You keep assuming that we mean to leave. We are settlers, not brigands. We won't be turned aside by nebulous promises and anti-mechanist propaganda. We are miners.
Pirates. Mech hirelings.
Lindsay shrugged one-sidedly.
Your arm, she said. Is it really hurt?
Or do you pretend it to make me think you're harmless?
Lindsay said nothing.
I take your point, she said. There's no true negotiation without trust. Somewhere we have common ground. Let's find it.
Lindsay straightened his arm.
All right, Nora. If this is between just the two of us, role-playing aside, let's hear you. I can bear any level of frankness you're willing to advance.
Tell me your name, then.
It won't mean anything to you. She was silent.
It's Abelard, he said.
Call me Abelard.
What's your gene line, Abelard?
I'm no shaper.
You're lying, Abelard. You move like one of us. The arm business camouflaged it, but your clumsiness is too deliberate. How old are you? 100? Less? How long have you been sundogging it?
Does that matter? Lindsay said.
You can go back. Believe me, it's different now. The Council needs you. I'll sponsor you. Join us, Abelard. We're your people, not these germy renegades.
Lindsay reached out. Nora drew back, the long laces of her sleeve ties jerking in freefall.
You see, Lindsay said, I'm as filthy as they are.
He watched her closely. She was beautiful.
The Mavridis clan was a gene line he hadn't seen before. Wide hazel eyes with a trace of epicanthic fold, more Amerindian than Oriental. High cheekbones, straight aquiline nose, feathery black eyebrows and a wealth of shimmering black hair, which in freefall formed a bushy mass of curled tendrils. Nora's hair was confined in a loose freefall headdress, a jade-green plastic turban with a crimson drawstring at the back, and a serrated fringe of forest green above her bangs. Her coppery skin was clear and inhumanly smooth, with a dusting of rouge. There were six of them. They had a close family resemblance, but they were not identical clones. The six were that tiny percentage of the Mavridis gene line which had been drafted. Cleo, Paolo, Fazil, Ian, Agnes, and Nora Mavridis. Cleo was their leader. She was 40. Nora was 28. The rest were all 17 years old. Lindsay had seen them. He'd pitied them. The Ring Council did not waste investment. A 17-year-old genius was more than sufficient for the assignment, and they were cheap. They had looked him over with cold hazel eyes, with the alert and revolted stare that a man reserves for vermin. They longed to kill him with a hunger tempered only by disgust. It was too late for that now. They should have killed him far away, when they could have stayed clean. Now he was too close. His skin, his breath, his teeth, even his blood seethed with corruption.
We have no antiseptics, Nora said. Never thought we'd need them. It won't be pleasant for us, Abelard. Boils, wheals, rashes, dysentery. There's no help for it. Even if you left tomorrow, the air from your ship, it was crawling.
She spread her hands. Her blouse had scarlet drawstrings at the wrist, with puffed slashed sleeves showing the smooth skin of her forearms. The blouse was a wraparound garment tied with short strings at each hip and belted at the waist. She'd sewn it herself, embroidering the lapels in pink and white gridwork. Below it, she wore shorts cinched at the knee and lace-up crimson sandals.
I'm sorry, Lindsay said, but it's better than dying. The Shapers are burned, Nora. They're finished. I have no love for the mechs, believe me.
For the first time, he gestured with his right arm.
Let me tell you something I'll deny if you repeat. The mechs wouldn't exist if it weren't for you. Their union of cartels is a sham. It's only united by fear and hatred of the reshaped. When they've destroyed the Ring Council, as they must, the mechs themselves will fly to pieces.
Please, Nora, see it my way for a moment, for the sake of argument. I know you're committed, I know you're loyal to your gene line, your people back home. But your death won't save them. They're burned, doomed. It's just you and us now. 18 people. I've lived with these Fortunans. We know what they are. They're scum, pirates, marauders, failures, victims, Nora. They live in the gap between what's right and what's possible. But if you go along, they won't kill you. It's your chance, a chance for the six here,
After they've shut you down, they'll go back to the cartels. If you surrender, they'll take you along. You're all young. Disguise your pasts, and in a century you could be running those cartels. Mech, Shaper, those are only labels. The point is that we live.
Your tools, the woman said.
Victims, yes, I'll accept that. We're victims ourselves. But victims in a better cause than yours. We came here naked, Abelard. We were shipped here in a one-way drogue. And the only reason we weren't blown away in flight is because the Council launches 50 decoys for every real mission. It costs the cartels more to kill us than we're worth. That's why they hired you. The rich mechs, the ones in power, have turned you on us. And we were surviving. We made this base from nothing with our hands, brains, and wetware. It was you who came to kill us.
But we're here now, Lindsay said.
What's past can't be helped. I'm begging you to let me live, and you give me ideology. Please, Nora, bend a little. Don't kill us all.
I want to live, she said. It's you who should join us here. Your lot won't be of much use, but we could tolerate you. We'll never be true shapers, but there's room for the unplanned under our aegis. In one way or another, we outflank every move the cartels make against us.
You're under siege, Lindsay said.
We break out. Haven't you heard? The concatenation will declare for us. We have one circumlunar already, the Mare Serenitatis Circumlunar Corporate Republic.
Even here, Constantine's shadow had touched him.
You call that a triumph? He said. Those decadent little worlds, those broken-down relics.
We will rebuild them, she said with chilling confidence. We own their youth.
Aboard the Red Consensus, 1117. Welcome aboard, Dr. Mavrides, the president said. He extended his hand. Nora shook it without hesitation. Her skin was protected under the thin plastic of her spacesuit.
A fine beginning for the new year, Lindsay said. They were on the control deck of the Red Consensus. Lindsay realized how much he'd missed the familiar pop, blip, and squeak of the instruments. The sound settled into him, releasing tension he hadn't known he had. The negotiations were 12 days old. He'd forgotten how bad the pirates looked, how consummately grubby. They had clogged pores, hair rank with grease, teeth rimmed with plaque. To his shaper's eyes, they looked like wild animals.
This is our third agreement, the president said formally. First, the Open Channels Act, then the Technological Assessment and Trade Consensus, and now a real breakthrough in social justice policy, the Integration Act. Welcome to the Red Consensus, Doctor. We hope you'll regard every angstrom of the craft as part of your national heritage.
The president pinned the printout treaty to a bulkhead and signed it with a flourish. Lindsay printed the state seal with his left hand. The flimsy paper ripped a little.
We're all nationals here, the president said. Let's relax a little. Get to, know each other.
He pulled a gunmetal inhaler and sniffed at it ostentatiously.
You sew that spacesuit yourself? The Speaker of the House said.
Yes, Madam Speaker. The seams are thread wire and epoxy from our wetware tanks.
Clever.
I like your roaches, said Rep. 2. Pink and gold and green. Hardly look like roaches at all. I'd like to have some of those.
That can be arranged, I'm sure, Nora said.
Trade you some relaxant for it. I have lots.
Thank you, Nora said.
She was doing well. Lindsay felt obscurely proud of her. She unzipped her spacesuit and stepped out of it. Below it, she wore a triangular over-the-shoulders poncho, geometrically embroidered in white and ice blue. The poncho's tapering ends were laced across her hips, leaving her legs bare except for lace-up Velcro sandals. The pirates had tactfully given up their red and silver skeleton jumpsuits. Instead, they wore dun-brown zaibatsu coveralls. They looked like savages.
I could do with one of these, said Rep. 3.
He held the accordioned arm of his ancient spacesuit next to the thin plastic of hers.
How you breathe in that sucker?
It's not for deep space. We just fill it with pure oxygen and breathe as long as we can.
10 minutes.
I could hook tanks to one. More spacey, citizen to be. The sun would like it.
We could teach you to sew one. It's an art worth knowing.
She smiled at Rep 3, and Lindsay shuddered inwardly. He knew how the sweaty reek of the Rep's suit must turn her stomach. He drifted between the two of them, unobtrusively nudging Rep 3 to one side. And for the first time, he touched Nora Mavrides. He put his hand gently on the soft blue and white shoulder of her poncho. The muscle beneath his hand was as stiff as a wire. She smiled again quickly.
I'm sure the others will find this ship fascinating. We came here in a drogue. Our cargo was 9/10 ice for the wetware tanks. We were in paste, close to dead. We had our robot and our pocket tokamak. The rest was bits and pieces. Wire, a handful of microchips, some salt and trace minerals. The rest's genetics. Eggs, seeds, bacteria. We came here naked to save launch weight. Everything else we've done with our hands, friends. Flesh against rock. Flesh wins if it's smart enough.
Lindsay nodded. She had not mentioned their electromagnetic pulse weapon. No one talked about the guns. She struggled to charm the pirates, but her pride stung them. The pride of the family was justified. They'd bootstrapped themselves into prosperity with bacterial wetware from gelatin capsules no bigger than pinheads. They had mastered plastics. They conjured them out of the rock. Their artifacts were as cheap as life itself. They had grown themselves into the rock, wormed their way in with soft-bodied, relentless persistence. Essayres was riddled with tunnels. Their sharp-toothed tunneling hoops ran around the clock. They had air blowers rigged from vinyl sacks and ribs of memory plastic. The ribs breathed. They were wired to the tokamak fusion plant, and a small change in voltage made them bend and flex, sucking in air with a pop of plastic lung and an animal wheeze of exhalation. It was the sound of life inside the rock, the rasp of the hoops, the blowers breathing, the sullen gurgling of the fermenters. They had plants, not just algae and protein goo, but flowers, roses, phlox, daisies, or plants that had known those names before their DNA had felt the scalpel. Celery, lettuce, dwarf corn, spinach, alfalfa, bamboo. With fine wire and merciless patience, they could warp bamboo into complex pipes and bottles. Eggs, they even had chickens, or things that had once been chickens, before Shaper gene splicers turned them into free-fall protein tools. They were powerful, subtle, and filled with desperate hatred. Lindsay knew that they were waiting for their chance, weighing odds, calculating. They would attack to kill if they could, but only when they could maximize the chance of their own survival. But he also knew that with each day that passed, with each minor concession and agreement, another frail layer of shellac was laid over the open break between them. Day by day, a new status quo struggled to form, a frail detente supported by nothing but habit. It was not much, but it was all he had. The hope that, with time, the facade of peace would take on substance. Essayres 12, 3, 2, 17.
Hey, Secretary of State!
Lindsay woke. In the ghost-like gravity of the asteroid, he had settled imperceptibly to the bottom of his cavern. They called his dugout the Embassy. With the passage of the Integration Act, Lindsay had moved into the rock with the rest of the FMD. Paolo had spoken. Fazil was with him. The two young men wore embroidered ponchos and stiff plastic crowns holding floating manes of shoulder-length hair. The skin bacteria had hit them badly. Every day they looked worse. Paolo's neck was so badly inflamed that his throat looked cut. Fazil's left ear was infected. He carried his head tilted to one side.
I want to show you something, Paolo said. Can you come with us, Mr. Secretary? Quietly?
His voice was gentle, his hazel eyes so clear and guileless that Lindsay knew at once that he was up to something. Would they kill him? Not yet. Lindsay laced on a poncho and struggled with the complex knots of his sandals.
I'm at your disposal, he said.
They floated into the corridor. The corridors between dugouts were no more than long wormholes, a meter across. The Mavridi's clansmen propelled themselves along with a quick side-to-side lizard-like skittering. Lindsay was slower. His injured arm was bad today, and his hand felt like a club. They glided silently through the soft yellow light of one of the fermenting rooms. The blunt, nippled ends of three wetware bags jutted into the room. They were stuffed like a string of sausages into stone tunnels. Each tunnel held a series of bags united by filters. Each bag passed its output to the next. The last bag had a spinneret running, a memory plastic engine, clacking slowly. A hollow tube of flawless, clear acrylic coiled in freefall, reeking as it dried. They entered another black tunnel. The tunnels were all identical, all perfectly smooth. There was no need for lighting. Any genius could easily memorize the nexus. To his left, Lindsay heard the slow clack rasp of a tunneling hoop. The hoops were handmade, their teeth hand-set in plastic, and they each sounded slightly different. They helped him navigate. They could gnaw 2 meters a day through the softer rock. In 2 years, they had gnawed over 20,000 tons of ore. When the ore was processed, the tailings were shot into space. Everything launched away left a hole behind it. A hole 10 kilometers long, pitch black, and as knotted as snarled fish line, beaded with living caverns, greenhouses, wetware rooms, and private hidey holes. They took a turn Lindsay had never used before. Lindsay heard the grating sound of a stone plug hauled away. They went a short distance, squirming past the flaccid bulk of a deactivated air blower. As Lindsay crawled past it in the darkness, the blower came to life with a gasp. "This is our secret place," Paolo said. "Mine and Fazil's." His voice echoed in the darkness. Something fizzed loudly with a leaping of white-hot sparks. Startled, Lindsay braced to fight. Paolo was holding a short white stick with flame gnawing at one end. "A candle," he said.
"Kindle?" said Lindsay.
"Yes, I see."
"We play with fire," Paolo said. "Fazil and I."
They were in a workshop cavern, dug into one of the large stony veins within Aesir's 12. The walls looked like granite to Lindsay's untrained eye, a grayish-pink rock studded with little gleams of rock crystal.
"There was quartz here," Paolo said. "Silicon dioxide. We mined it for oxygen. Then Cleo forgot about it. So we drilled this room ourselves. Right, Fazil?"
Fazil spoke eagerly.
"That's right, Mr. Secretary. We used hand drills and expansion plastic. See where the rock shattered and came loose? We hid the chunks in the debris for launch, so that no one knew. We worked for days and saved the biggest chunk."
"Look," Paolo said.
He touched the wall and the stone wrinkled in his hand and came away. In a broken-out rough cavity the size of a closet, an oblong boulder floated, kept from falling by a thread. Paolo snapped the thread and pulled the boulder out. It moved sluggishly. Fazil helped him stop its inertia. It was a 2-ton sculpture of Paolo's head.
"Very fine work," Lindsay said.
"May I?"
He ran his fingertips across the slickly polished cheekbone. The eyes, wide and alert, cored out for pupils, were as big as his outstretched hands. There was a faint smile on the enormous lips.
"When they sent us out here, we knew we weren't coming back," Paolo said. "We'll die here. And why? Not because our genetics are bad. We're a good line. Mavridis rule!"
He was talking faster now, falling into the cadences of the Ring Council slang. Fazil nodded silently.
"It's just bad percentages. Chance. We were burned by chance before we were 20 years old. You can't edit out chance. Some of the gene lines are bound to fall so the rest can live. If it weren't me and Fazil, it would be our Krehemates."
"I understand," Lindsay said.
"We were young and cheap. They throw us into the enemy's teeth so the ink is black, not red. But we're alive, me and Fazil. There's something inside us. We'll never see 10% of the life the others back home will see. But we were here. We're real."
"Living is better," Lindsay said.
"You're a traitor,"
Paolo said without resentment.
Without a gene line, you're bloodless. You're just a system.
There are more important things than living, Fazil said.
If you had enough time, you'd outlive this war, Lindsay said.
Paolo smiled.
There is no war. This is evolution in action.
You think you'll outlive that?
Lindsay shrugged.
Maybe. What if aliens come?
Paolo looked at him wide-eyed.
You believe in that? The aliens?
Maybe.
You're all right, Paolo said.
How can I help you? Lindsay said.
It's the launch ring. We plan to launch this head. An oblique launch, top velocity, full power, off the plane of the ecliptic. Maybe somebody sees it someday. Maybe something, 500 million years, no trace of human life, picks it up, my face. There's no debris off the plane, no collisions, just dead space vacuum. Perfect. And it's good hard rock. Out this far, the sun could go giant red and barely warm it. It could orbit till white dwarf stage, maybe till black cinder, till the galaxy bursts, or the cosmos eats its own tail. My image, forever.
Only first we have to launch it, said Fazil.
The president won't like it, Lindsay said. The first treaty we signed said no more launches for the duration. Maybe later, when our trust is stronger.
Paolo and Fazil traded glances. Lindsay knew at once that things were out of hand.
Look, he said. You two are talented. You have a lot of time on your hands since the launch ring's down. You could do heads of all of us.
No, Paolo shouted. It's between us two, that's it.
What about you, Fazil? Don't you want one?
We're dead, Fazil said. This took us 2 years. There was only time for one. Chance burned us both. One of us had to give everything for nothing. So we decided. Show him, Paolo.
He shouldn't look, Paolo said sullenly. He doesn't understand.
I want him to know, Paolo, Fazil was stern. Why I have to follow, and you get to lead. Show him, Paolo.
Paolo reached under his poncho and pulled out a hinged box of clear acrylic. There were 2 stone cubes in it. Black cubes with white dots on their faces. Dice. Lindsay licked his lips. He had seen this in the Ring Council. Endemic gambling, not just for money, but for the core of personality. Secret agreements, dominance games, sex. The struggles within gene lines, between people who knew with flat certainty that they were equally matched. The dice were quick and final.
I can help you, Lindsay said. Let's negotiate.
We're supposed to be on duty, Paolo said, monitoring radio. We're leaving, Mr. Secretary.
I'll come along, Lindsay said.
The 2 shapers resealed the stone lid of their secret workshop and scuttled off in the darkness. Lindsay followed the best he could. The shapers had listening dishes dug in all over the asteroid. The bowl-shaped impact craters were ready-made for their camouflaged gridworks of copper mesh. All antennae fed into a central processor, whose delicate semiconductors were sheltered in a tough acrylic console. Slots on the console held cassettes of homemade recording tape, constantly spooling on 12 different heads. Another cutout on the acrylic deck held a flat liquid crystal display for video copy and a hand-lettered keyboard. The 2 genetics combed the waveband, flickering through a spectrum of general-issue cartel broadcasts. Most bands were cipher-static, anonymous blips of cybernetic data pulse.
Here's something, Paolo said. Triangulate it, Fazil.
It's close, Fazil said. Oh, it's just the madman.
What? Lindsay said. A huge green roach, speckled in lustrous violet, flew past with a clatter of wings.
The one who always wears the spacesuit.
The 2 glanced at one another. Lindsay read their eyes. They were thinking about the man's stench.
Is he talking? Lindsay said.
Put him on, please.
He always talks, Paolo said. Sings, mostly. He raves into an open channel.
He's in his new spacesuit,
Lindsay said urgently. Put 'em on. He heard Rep 3.
Granulated like my mother's face. And sorry not to say goodbye to my friend Mars. Sorry for Carnival, too. I'm out kilometers, and that hiss. I thought it was a new friend, trying to talk, but it's not. It's a little hole in my back, where I glued the tanks in. Tanks work fine. Hole works better. It's me and my two skins. Soon both cold.
Try and raise him, Lindsay said.
I told you he keeps the channel open. The unit's 200 years old if it's a day. He can't hear us when he talks.
I'm not reeling back in. I'm staying out here.
His voice was fainter.
No air to talk with. No air to listen. So I'll try and climb out. Just a zipper. With any luck, I can skin out completely.
There was a light crackle of static.
Goodbye, sun. Goodbye, stars. Thanks for...
The words were lost in a rush of decompression. Then the crackling of static was back. It went on and on. Lindsay thought it through. He spoke quietly.
Was I your alibi, Paolo?
What?
Paolo was shocked. You sabotaged his suit, and then you carefully weren't here when we could have helped him. Paolo was pale.
We were never near his suit, I swear.
Then why weren't you here at your post?
Cleo set me up,
Paolo shouted.
Ian walks point. The dice said so. I'm supposed to be clean.
Shut up, Paolo.
Fazil grabbed his arm. Paolo tried to stare him down, then turned to Lindsay.
It's Cleo and Ian. They hate my luck.
Fazil shook him. Paolo slapped him hard across the face. Fazil cried out and threw his arms around Paolo, holding him close. Paolo looked stricken.
I was upset, he said. I lied about Cleo. She loves all of us. It was an accident. An accident.
Lindsay left. He scrambled headlong down the tunnels, passing more wetware and a greenhouse where a blower gusted the smell of fresh-cut hay. He entered a cavern where grow lights shone dusky red through a gas-permeable membrane. Nora's room branched off from the cavern, blocked by the wheezing bulk of her private air blower. Lindsay squeezed past it on the exhale and slapped the lights. Violet arabesques covered the room's round walls. Nora was sleeping. Her arms, her legs, were gripped in wire. Braces circled her wrists and elbows, ankles and knees. Black myo electrodes studded the muscle groups beneath her naked skin. The arms, the legs, moved quietly, in unison, side, side, forward, back. A long carapace knobbed her back, above the branching nerve clumps of her spine. It was a diplomatic training device, a spinal crab. Memory flashed behind Lindsay's eyes and he went berserk. He jumped off the wall and rocketed toward her. Her eyes snapped open, blearily, as he shouted in fury. He seized her neck and jerked it forward, digging his nails into the rubbery rim where the spinal crab met her skin. He tore at it savagely. Part of it ripped free. The skin shone red beneath it, slick with sweat. Lindsay grabbed the left arm cable and snapped it loose. He pulled harder. She wheezed as a strap dug in under her ribs. The crab was peeling away. Its underside was ghastly. A 100-footed mass of damp, translucent tubes poured with hair-thin wires. Lindsay ripped again. A cable nexus stretched and snapped, extruding colored wires. He braced his feet against her back and pulled. She gagged and clawed at the strap's buckle. The belt whipped loose, and Lindsay had the whole thing. With its programming disrupted, it flopped and curled like a live thing. Lindsay whirled it by the straps and slammed it into the wall with all his strength. The interlapping segments of its back split open, their brittle plastic crackling. He whiplashed it into the stone. Brown lubricant oozed, then spattered into free-fall drops as he smashed it again. He crushed it underfoot, tore at the strap until it gave way. Its guts showed beneath the plates, lozenge-shaped biochips nested in multicolored fiber optics. He slammed it again, more slowly. The fury was leaving him. He felt cold. His right arm trembled uncontrollably.
Nora was against the wall, gripping a clothes rack. The sudden loss of nerve programming left her shaky with palsy.
"Where's the other one?" Lindsay demanded. "The one for your face."
Her teeth chattered.
"I didn't bring it," she said.
Lindsay kicked the crab away.
"How long, Nora? How long have you been under that thing?"
"I wear it every night."
"Every night? My God!"
"I have to be the best,"
she said, shaking. She fumbled a poncho from the rack and ducked her head through the collar.
"But the pain," Lindsay said. "The way it burns."
Nora smoothed the bright fabric from her shoulders to hips.
"You're one of them," she said. "The early classmates. The failures. The defectors."
"What was your class?" Lindsay said.
"Fifth. The last one."
"I was first," Lindsay said. "The foreign section."
"Then you're not even a shaper."
"I'm a concatenate."
"You're all supposed to be dead."
She peeled the crab's broken braces from her knees and ankles.
"I should kill you.
You attacked me.
You're a traitor."
"When I smashed that thing, I felt real freedom."
He rubbed his arm absently, marveling. He truly lost control. Rebellion had overwhelmed him. For a moment, sincere human fury had burned through the training, touched a hot core of genuine rage. He felt shaken, but more whole, more truly himself than he'd been for years.
"Your kind ruined it for the rest of us," Nora said. "We diplomats should be on top, coordinating things, making peace. But they shut down the whole program. We're undependable, they said. A bad ideology."
"They want us dead," Lindsay said. "That's why you were drafted."
"I wasn't drafted. I volunteered."
She tied the poncho's last hip lace.
"I'll have a hero's welcome if I make it back. That's the only chance I'll ever have at power in the rings."
"There are other powerful places."
"None that count."
"Rep 3 is dead," Lindsay told her. "Why did you kill him?"
"Three reasons," she said.
They were past pretense.
"It was easy. It helps our odds against you. And third, he was crazy. Worse even than the rest of your crew. Too unpredictable and too dangerous to let live."
"He was harmless," Lindsay said. "Not like the two of us."
His eyes filled with tears.
"If you had my control, you wouldn't weep. Not if they tore your heart out."
"They already have," Lindsay said. "And yours as well."
"Abelard," she said. "He was a pirate."
"And the rest?"
"You think they'd weep over us?"
"No," Lindsay said. "And not much, even over their own. It's vengeance they'll want. How would you feel if Ian disappears tomorrow? And 2 months from now you find his bones in the sludge drain of some fermenter. Or better yet, your nerves are so well steeled. What about yourself? How would power taste if you were retching bloody foam outside some airlock?"
"It's in your hands," she said. "I've told you the truth, as we agreed between us. It's up to you to control your faction."
"I won't be put in this position," Lindsay said. "I thought we had an understanding."
She pointed at the oozing wreckage of her spinal crab.
"You didn't ask my permission to attack me. You saw something you couldn't bear, and you destroyed it. We did the same."
"I want to talk to Cleo," he said.
She looked hurt.
"That's against our understanding. You talk through me."
"This is murder, Nora. I have to see her."
Nora sighed.
"She's in the garden. You'll have to put on a suit."
"Mine's in the consensus."
"We'll use one of Ian's then. Come on."
She led him back into the glowing cavern, then down a long fissured-out mining vein to Ian Mavrides' room. The spacesuit maker and graphic artist was awake and working. He had refused to put his decontamination suit aside and wore it constantly, a one-man sterile environment. Ian was point man for the Mavrides family, a focus for threats and resentment. Paolo had blurted as much, but Lindsay knew it already.
The round walls of Ian's dugout were neatly stenciled in gridwork. For weeks he'd been decorating it with an elaborate geometric mosaic of interlocking L-shapes. With the passage of time, the shapes were smaller, more tightly packed, crammed together in obsessive, crawling rigor. Its intricacy was claustrophobic, smothering. The tiny squares seemed to writhe and flicker. When they entered, Ian whirled, putting his hand to one bulky sleeve pocket.
"It's us," Nora said.
Behind the faceplate, Ian's eyes were wild.
"Oh," he said. "Get burned."
"Save it for the others," Lindsay said. "I'd be more impressed if you got some sleep, Ian."
"Sure," said Ian. "So you could come in here and pull my suit off and contaminate me."
Nora said,
"We need a suit, Ian. State is going to the garden."
"Fuck him. He's not stinking up one of my suits. He can sew his own, like Rep 3 did."
"You're clever with suits, Ian." Lindsay wondered if Ian had been the one to murder Rep 3. They had probably rolled dice for the privilege. He pulled a suit from the rack.
"If you take your suit off, I might not put this on."
"What do you say? I'll roll you."
Ian pressed an oxygen balloon against the intake nozzle of his suit.
"Don't test your luck, cripple."
Cleo lived in the largest greenhouse. It was ornamental. It grew more slowly than the wormhole industrial gardens where vegetation rioted under grow lights in pure carbon dioxide. The room was oblong, and its long walls had the ribbed look of a seashell. Brilliant light poured from fluorescent tubes along each ridge. The soil was mine tailings, held by dampness and a fine plastic mesh. Like the shapers themselves, the plants were altered to live without bacteria. They were flowers, mostly. Roses, daisies, buttercups the size of fists. Cleo's bed was of roofed-in wickerwork, grown from curved bamboo. She was awake, working on an embroidery hoop. Her skin was darker than the others. The grow lights had tanned her. She wore a sleeveless white blouse cinched at the waist, hanging in multiple thin folds. Her legs and feet were bare. There was an embroidered logo of rank above her heart.
"Hello, dear," she said. "Cleo?"
Nora floated into the wickerwork structure and lightly kissed Cleo's cheek.
"At his insistence, I..."
Cleo nodded once.
"I hope you'll make this brief," she told Lindsay. "My garden is not for the unplanned."
"I want to discuss the murder of the third representative." Cleo tucked a lock of curled hair into her braided hairnet. The proportions of her wrist, palm, and forearm showed that she was older than the rest, from an earlier production run.
"Nonsense," she said. "An absurd allegation."
"I know you had him killed, Cleo. Maybe you did it yourself. Be frank with me."
"That man's death was an accident. There's no proof otherwise. Therefore, we bear no blame."
"I'm trying to save our lives, Cleo. Please spare me the party line. If Nora admits the truth, why can't you?"
"What you discuss with our negotiator in secret session is not our business, Mr. Secretary. The Mavridis family cannot acknowledge anything unproven."
"That's it, then?" Lindsay said from behind his faceplate. "Crimes don't exist outside your ideology? You expect me to join that fiction, lie for you, protect you?"
"We're your people," Cleo said,
fixing him with her clear hazel eyes.
"But you've killed my friend."
"That's not a valid allegation, Mr. Secretary."
"This is useless," Lindsay said.
He bent, grabbed a thornless rosebush, and ripped it up by the roots. He shook it. Blobs of wet dirt flew. Cleo winced.
"Look," Lindsay said. "Don't you understand?"
"I understand that you're a barbarian," Cleo said. "You destroyed a thing of beauty to make a point in an argument you know I can't accept."
"Bend a little," Lindsay pleaded. "Have mercy."
"That's not our assignment," Cleo told him.
Lindsay turned and left, stripping off the clammy spacesuit just beyond the airlock.
"I told you not to try it," Nora said.
"She's suicidal," Lindsay said.
"Why?
Why do you follow her?
Because she loves us.
Esers 12, 23 to 17.
Let me tell you about sex, Nora said. Give me your hand.
Lindsay gave her his left hand. Nora gripped his wrist, pulled him forward, and put his thumb deep into her mouth. She held it there, then released him.
Tell me what you felt.
It was warm, Lindsay said. Wet, and uncomfortably intimate.
That's what sex is like on suppressants, she said. We have love in the family, but not erotics. We're soldiers.
You're chemically castrated, then?
You're prejudiced, she said. You haven't lived it. That's why the orgy you propose is out of the question.
Carnival isn't an orgy, Lindsay said. It's a ceremony. It's trust. It's communion. It holds the group together, like animals huddling.
It's too much to ask, she said.
You don't realize what's at stake. It's not your body they want. They want to kill you. They hate your sterile guts. You don't know how I talked, persuaded, coaxed them. Listen, they use hallucinogens. Your brain turns to pudding in carnival. You don't know what your own hands are, much less someone else's genitals. You're helpless. Everyone is helpless, that's the point. No more games, no politics, no rank and grudges, no self. When you come out of carnival, it's like the first day of creation. Everyone smiles.
Lindsay looked aside, blinking.
It's real, Nora. It's not their government that sustains them. That's just the brain. Carnival is the blood, the spine, the groin.
It's not our way, Abelard.
But if you could join us, even once, for a few hours, we'd dissolve these tensions, truly trust each other. Listen, Nora, sex is not some handicraft. It's real. It's human. It's one of the last things we have left.
Burn it. What do you have to lose?
It could be an ambush, she said. You could bend our minds with drugs and kill us. It's a risk.
Of course it is, but there are ways around that. He locked eyes with her. I'm telling you this on the basis of all the trust we have between us. At least we can give it a trial.
I don't like this, Nora said. I don't like sex, especially with the unplanned.
It's that or juice your own gene line, Lindsay said. He pulled a loaded hypodermic from inside his lapel and attached its needle.
I have mine ready.
She looked at it sidelong, then produced her own.
You may not take well to this, Abelard.
What is it?
Suppressant, with phenylxanthine to kick your IQ up, so you'll see how we feel.
This isn't the full carnival mixture, Lindsay said. Just the aphrodisiacs, half strength, and muscle relaxant. I think you need it since I smashed the spinal crab. You seem jumpy.
You seem to know all too well what I need.
That makes two of us. Lindsay pulled aside the loose sleeve of his wraparound blouse. This is it, Nora. You could kill me now and call it allergic reaction, stress, anything. He looked at the gaudy tattoos on the skin of his arm.
Don't do it.
She shared his suspicion.
Are you taping this?
I don't allow tapes in my room. He pulled a pair of elastic cords from a styrene cabinet and passed her one. He tied off his bicep. She did the same. With their sleeves rolled up, they waited quietly for the veins to swell. It was the most intimate moment they had ever had together. The thought aroused him. She slipped her hypodermic into the crook of his elbow and found the vein by the sudden rosette of blood at the needle's root. He did the same. They stared into each other's eyes and pressed the plungers home. The moment passed. Lindsay withdrew the needle and pressed a sterile plastic dot against her puncture. Then he did his own. They loosened the cords.
Neither of us seems to be dying, she said.
It's a good sign, Lindsay said. He tossed the cords aside.
So far so good? Oh,
she half closed her eyes.
It's hitting me. Oh, Abelard.
How do you feel? He took her shoulder.
The nexus of bone and muscle seemed to soften under his hand. She was breathing shallowly, lips parted, her eyes dark.
"Like I'm melting," she said.
The phenylxanthine hit him first. He felt like a king.
"You wouldn't hurt me," he said. "We're two of a kind, you and I."
He undid the ties and pulled her blouse off, then peeled the trousers inside out over her feet. He left the sandals on. His clothes flapped as he threw them off. They spun slowly in midair. He pulled her close, his eyes blazing.
"Help me breathe," she whispered.
The relaxant had hit her lungs. Lindsay took her chin in his hands, opened her mouth, and sealed his lips around it. He puffed gently and felt her ribs expand against his chest. Her head lolled back. The muscles of her neck were like wax. He hooked his legs around hers, from the inside, and breathed for her. She let her arms drift sluggishly around his neck. She pulled her mouth back a fraction of an inch.
"Try now."
He tried to enter her. Despite his own excitement, it was useless. The aphrodisiacs hadn't hit her yet, and she was dry.
"Don't hurt me," she said.
"I want you," Lindsay said. "You belong to me, not to those others."
"Don't say that," she said, her voice slurring. "This is an experiment."
"For them, maybe. Not for us." The phenylxanthine had made him certain and reckless in his certainty. "The rest don't matter. I'd kill any one of them at a word from you. I love you, Nora. Tell me you love me."
"I can't say that," she winced.
"You're hurting me."
"Say you trust me, then."
"I trust you. There, it's done. Hold still a moment." She wrapped her legs around him, then rocked her hips from side to side, settling around him.
"This is it, then. Sex."
"Haven't you had it before?"
"In the academy once, on a bet. It wasn't like this."
"You feel all right?"
"I'm comfortable. Go ahead, Abelard."
But now his curiosity was aroused. "Did they give you the pleasure tap, too? I had it once, an interrogation drill."
"Of course they did, but that was nothing human, just white ecstasy."
She was sweating.
"Come on, darling."
"No, wait a minute." He blinked as she clutched his waist. "I see what you mean. This is stupid, isn't it? We're friends already."
"I want you, Abelard. Come on, finish me."
"We've proven our point. Besides, I'm filthy."
"I don't care how fucking filthy you are. For God's sake, hurry."
He tried to oblige her then, and worked away mechanically for almost a minute. She bit her lip and groaned in anticipation, rolling her head back. But all the meaning had leached out of it for him. "I can't go on," he said. "I just don't see why we should bother."
"Just let me use you. Come on."
He tried to think of something arousing. The usual damp whirl of his mind's erotic imagery seemed abstract and distant to him, like something done by another species. He thought of his ex-wife. Sex with Alexandrina had been something like this, an act of politeness, an obligation. He held still, letting her slam herself against him. At last, a cry of desperate pleasure escaped her. She pulled away, patting sweat from her face and neck with the sleeve of her blouse. She smiled shyly. Lindsay shrugged. "I see your point. It's a waste of time. I may have some trouble talking the others into it, but if I can reason with them..." She looked at him hungrily.
"I made a mistake. It shouldn't have been this awful for us. I feel selfish now, since you had nothing."
"I feel fine," Lindsay insisted.
"You said you loved me."
"That was just hormones talking. Of course I have a deep respect for you, a sense of comradeship. I'm sorry I told you that. Forgive me, I didn't mean it, of course."
"Of course," she said,
putting on her blouse.
"Don't be bitter," Lindsay said.
"You should take some of this. I'm grateful for it. I see it now in a way I never did before. Love, it has no substance. It might be right for other people, other places, another time."
not us.
No. I feel bad about it now, reducing our negotiations to a sexual stereotype. You must have found it insulting and inconvenient.
I feel sick, she said.